So, if you and Pierre, if you are Pierre, you haven't had a chance, have you? What, preparing this?
No, I haven't even looked at it.
No, okay, that's fine. I mean, it might be that Donna and Patricia and I rattle through it. I don't know about you, Sebastian. Have you had much chance to look at this? No, okay. And I did send it late. So, I think maybe we take that on board. And I'm wondering if we can just zhuzh it up a little bit with perhaps a little bit of role play. But let's first of all just shall I rattle through question one? Okay, how would you introduce or explain second standard exercise? Of course, you're never going to explain anything without first of all finding out how your client has been getting on in the previous week. So nothing comes out of the blue. It one thing always leads to another, and I think that's a good thing to grasp when you're teaching AT. Warmth has only comes about because they've been doing heaviness. So you'll have had their feedback, had a bit of discussion how they're getting on, and explain that warmth is the next exercise. It's the next thing that Schultz's clients were describing when they were under hypnosis. So he thought he would add this in. Also, we can acknowledge relaxation relaxes the muscles. We've already got that going with heaviness. Even if we're not aware of heaviness, we are relaxed when we're practicing, or we should be. And within those muscles are the blood vessels, or within many organs in the body are also the blood vessels. The blood vessel walls relax. And because of that, we have improved circulation through the blood vessels. And that often manifests in a skin temperature rise, which has been measured, only minimal, but a little bit of rise in the skin temperature shows that the concept of warmth can actually be present. Whether we notice it or not doesn't matter. We're just going to put the words in, and that's what we're doing for our warmth exercise. Any questions so far? No. I think that's a good enough background. And then, of course, actually, the first thing I do, but people do this in different styles, but I hand out the sheet straight away before I've even said any of that. I hand it out because I actually quite like getting the feedback from them with the look on their face when they see how long this exercise is. And so it's quite a good idea just to prepare them and you that this is going to be a long one, and what's their reaction to it as you give it to them. And then you can say, well, this is the next one. It is about warmth, and explain what I've just said. Okay. And then now let's look at the exercise. Well, you already know some of it. It does look very long, but you already know some of it. You know the top end of it. My right arm is heavy, and my arms and legs are heavy. And you know the end of it, which is neck and shoulders, and I'm at peace. And of course, that was last week's exercise. So in between, I often refer to as a warmth sandwich, that we're actually a sandwich. Okay, so we're putting warmth in the middle of the beginning and the end of last week's exercise. And so it's actually quite easy to remember because the warm phrase is going in exactly the same pattern as the heavy phrases. So that's a bit of practical idea, and that's all I explain. Oh, except that of course whether you feel warm or not doesn't matter, and all sorts of different reactions occur, so we can't ever lay down the law what it's going to feel like. But I do always say, yes, it is a very long exercise, and I really don't want you to linger over it. That's the other thing I say. Otherwise, you're going to stretch it out into something that it isn't. And if you try and make something warm, it's certainly not going to. So you might as well just roll over the phrases in a regular rhythm, not too slow. Absolutely not too slow. And then you will close. And then I say to the clients, and what will you do when you close that exercise? And hopefully they will say, do another one. Yes, correct. They will do a set of three for there. That's as Anne was saying, always check and then always repeat these instructions. Don't assume. Yeah. So I think that answers that one. Anybody? Oh, yep.
Just, would you also tell people to tell your clients that these are this longest exercise that you would ever introduce them
Yes,
to?
I do. I'm sorry that I do absolutely say that, and I'm sorry I missed that out just now. Thank you, Patricia. Yes, because it is quite unnerving to see that great long thing. Yes, clearly you say that to them as well. Very good.
Yeah,
Yeah,
and it's
reassure
around,
them,
yeah.
and we can say, well, we'll go shorter again next week. So we've got it for this time. Let's see what it feels like. Yeah. I had an immediate reaction. Here's a story. I was working with somebody who had very, very bad eczema. You couldn't tell, actually, because the only part of his body that he didn't have it on, he told us, was his face. And he was always dressed in a business suit and the tie and the shirt and everything else. And he said, I have very bad eczema and it is very badly affected by heat. I don't think I want to do this exercise. Now, I didn't quite know how to respond, except as we always do, well, look, let's try it and see, because we don't actually know. It could be that your body chooses not to recognize it in the same way as other people's bodies do. So let's do it. We did it in the session. He was absolutely fine. In fact, I was doing a distance course at that time, and it was 2 weeks before I saw him again. But I hadn't heard from him. I had said, please email me if you've got a problem. And anyway, when we met up again, his report was quite interesting. He said, well, the funny thing is that I couldn't, I didn't, I never felt any warmth. I was quite disappointed. So I reminded him of the conversation we had. And I said, well, that's probably a good thing, isn't it? Because you didn't really want warmth. He said, no, but I mean, but it was very odd. Because I did get some warmth, and it was in the palms of my hands. And so I was most intrigued. And I said, well, was that comfortable? How did that feel? He said, yes, it was fine. It was fine. Now, the conclusion that we came to was that his body didn't want any extra warmth. It wasn't going to react to the warmth like that. But where did he get his warmth? In the palms of his hands. And he confirmed when I asked him the question that was the only part of his body where he didn't have any eczema, because the whole skin foundation is different in the palms and on the soles of the feet as well to anywhere else in the body. And I was astonished, as you can tell, that that story has stuck in my head, how the individual experiences the exercise, I'll say, as they need to. He got his tolerance from trusting that he actually wasn't going to do anything terrible, which he had been expecting. There we go.
Fascinating.
It is extraordinary, isn't it? Have you got any stories, Patricia or Donna?
Just put me in mind of my cousin's son who had very bad eczema, and they used to go every year somewhere like Greece where it
Oh
was hot and sunny,
yeah, oh yes.
and it seemed to cure him, the sun and the salt water, and he his eczema just went. And that was hot, that was a lot of heat, all day long, all night.
It's extraordinary, isn't it? And of course, I suppose what we're also talking about in our cold climes, if someone is dressed up as we do in this country, against the not against the sun, but we're just dressing up for warmth. We can actually make ourselves perhaps sweat sometimes, and then we've got moisture in the mix. But what you're talking about, of course, is the dry heat in Greece, which must have that part of it. And salt water, though, you'd have to be very careful if the skin was broken, wouldn't you? That would be really uncomfortable. Or would it?
I don't know. I don't know the details. I mean, I just remember my mother telling me about it.
Interesting. Right. Thank you. Donna, any stories or you move on?
Yeah, not to do with warmth specifically, so.
No. Okay. How would you deal with a strong reaction, with an unusual strong reaction? You're mute, Pia.
Sorry. Just say slightly warm.
Slightly, yes. And we're into reduce, omit, postpone. So we can reduce slightly, absolutely. Or just the hand, yes. So we can do all of that. Or we could even say, I was half expecting this guy to email or something. And I might have said, look, don't worry about it at all. Let's just go back to short stitch and let things settle down. Because if he's had a difficult time with it, it's perhaps better not even to use warm at all. That would be my feeling if it had been really quite strong. Because it's enough to put people off. So put them back on something they're safe with. Say, Heaviness Part 2, maybe. Yeah. But actually, you're quite right. That is the theory. Reduce or omit, as I have just suggested, actually, haven't I? Or postpone is another way. What would we be doing there? What is postponing?
Short stitch or a holding exercise?
Sorry, I'm sorry, I didn't hear, Sebastian.
Short stitch.
Short stitch, yes, absolutely. So we are actually, by postponing, we are omitting, and then we've got the possibility of reintroducing it later on, putting warmth in when other things are already in place and it suddenly feels all right and comfortable. Yeah, but that's right, short stitch is always the fallback, actually. Yeah. All right, that's warmth. How long were we on that? Too long, right. Who wants to do the anger one? Donna?
Yeah, can do. Give the rationale for the introduction of the... okay, so I would be moving on from already giving them earlier the motor garbage. I can't remember the names of it, but the other two.
The noise.
Taking. Thank you very much. So I'd build up from that, remind them of that, moving on, and say that sometimes when we're doing autogenics, it can stir up emotions. And that Luther had devised these exercises to take care of that.
Lovely.
I think, and then obviously tell them what it is.
Indeed. And that is about, that's the introduction, isn't it? And it's and I think what you've just said is really important, always set the context. When we're asked a question like this, you've just answered it beautifully. And I was saying earlier, wasn't I? We take the feedback before we go in. Mm. Nobody dives into anything without the context in place. Yeah. So, yeah.
And they could have already been saying, I've been feeling a bit off this week and a bit agitated or what have you, but I do the anger awareness as well week, so yes. It's always in their mind that something's going to happen with anger,
yes,
this week.
And I give the anger awareness bit in the context, funnily enough, of giving the motor garbage and the noise garbage, because it could all go into a mix, and you know that this is quite useful however we're feeling at any moment. So so actually, awareness of everything is important, isn't it, in the end? Absolutely. But yes, you've signalled it up good and proper for them. Right, and then you explain what it is and how to do it. Are we all comfortable with what it is and how to do it? Mm-hmm. The intentional offloading of anger. Are you using it yourself, Sebastian and Pia? You've done the anger
exercise? I've done it just to try it, you know, having the pet person sit on the other side of me type of thing in front of me and just giving them heaps. But there haven't been anything really that I need to be. But I've done it just to try it.
Yes. Well, good. And what about you, Sebastian?
Perhaps, as you already know, yeah, I've done it several times because I had an issue in the past with my manager and... that helped me to get rid of a lot of unwanted thoughts. And definitely, I felt released afterwards. But one day, someone heard me swearing. And, are you all right? What were you talking with? And I said, no. I just received a phone call and I wasn't really happy with it. You know, I had to find an excuse, you know.
But we definitely. Can... Yes, you are... gracefully blessed Sebastian with someone who has taught you quite a lot of your personal AT, who also has a very short memory. So I'm not, I don't remember everything that you've ever done, but I do remember that story now you tell it.
Many times, yeah. Many times. Yeah, I mean, since we started,
This is really good, because trying it out is one thing, but when you realize that doing it has actually brought some kind of, shall we call it, a result, it will help you enormously when you're teaching it to other people. So not that you have to tell them your stories or anything like that, nothing like that, but you can say this is really, really useful.
And what else I noticed, I mean, actually, you were the one pointing out what happened a few times while practicing the anxiety of loading. At some point, it turned into anger, you know. I was fed up with the same expression. I said, you know what, I had enough. I'm not anymore.
Yes. So when you have your own links between the offloading exercises, they're much easier to teach. And if we've tried it out, it's still a wee bit theoretical. At least you know what it's like, and you might have felt really silly while you did it, so that you can pass on to your clients. Or, you know, do be careful you're not overheard. But even if you're overheard, you can make an excuse, just like we've heard from Sebastian, true. And all of that. So all of that adds to our what shall we say, knowledge that we are imparting. Yeah. Okay. Okay. So that's number two. Number three. Now, number three, I'm going to say it's quite unusual to have anybody in these situations, but it does happen at the hospital, actually. I remember somebody.
Maybe in your case, but being honest with you, for example, if I'll come across, perhaps I would refuse, because I find it quite difficult to deal with, I believe. Deaf, how are you going to write down on a piece of paper, or I don't know.
Well, the interesting thing is there's a lot of technology around now, and at the hospital we do get some of these situations, and I do remember somebody who was quite profoundly deaf. She had a little gizmo where if she was in a group, when the next person in the group was going to speak, she would hand them the gizmo. It was a little what shall we say, sound enhancer, which came through into her ears. And so then when the next person was going to speak, we handed on the gizmo and she could hear everything. And of course, then I had the gizmo when I was doing the teaching. So actually, there are things around to help these situations. But I don't really think that we need to sort of spend an awful lot of time on this now, because when you've got the situation, you will be asking, what the client themselves, how we can manage this. Similarly, with somebody who is visually impaired, again, it's where are they with their sight? Can they manage to get to the building? This lady who could hardly see anything at all except shadows came to the hospital every single week under her own steam, getting on the underground, getting off at the right station, knowing where she was walking. She had a stick, people offered. She was amazing. And she would get up to the third floor and sit in the reception area. And then once we'd passed week one, the group who were also sitting up there waiting for the session to start would go to her and say, "Hi, Liz, would you like my arm and I'll take you down the corridor?" And so, you know, these things happen spontaneously. They are very much in the moment. I wouldn't really feel that you would need to answer this question, because there is no one answer that's going to fit every situation. And I've got a story about paralyzed from the waist down. My quick answer to this question is I would teach them autogenic training absolutely normally. I really would. I mean, it could be that I've done a domestic visit to their house because they might be bedbound or they in the wheelchair or however it is. And I would teach them normal AT. It's not up to me, because they can't move their legs, to second guess what autogenic training is going to do for them. So as with all the rest of autogenic training, just do it. Try an exercise. See what it feels like. So the story I have actually isn't about paralysis, but it is about somebody who he was a soldier and he only had one leg. And when I assessed him, I really thought that we were going to have quite a conversation about the combat that he was in and the stress and the post-traumatic stress disorder of his being wounded, and et cetera, et cetera. None of that. None of that. He was wanting to learn autogenic training because he'd read about it somewhere that it helped pistol shooting. And he was in the pistol shooting team in his regiment, and he wanted to improve his pistol shooting. So I thought, oh, well, all right, that's fine, good, okay. But I wondered how we were going to get on with arms and legs heavy and all of that. So again, when, and he was in a group, and so we got to learning the heaviness exercise, and off we trotted. And he, oh, sorry, I'm being silly. Of course, I explained it and everything else, and here is the exercise. And of course, I turned to him, or did he ask me? I can't remember. What happens to me? I've only got one leg. Do I leave my right leg out of it? And I said, well, actually, we're all going to be doing it anyway, so let's find out. I don't think we need to make any such decision. We'll find out what it felt like for you. So I led them all through, first of all, the arms one, because that's what we do first for the first 3 days. So that one, you know, it was fine. So he had an idea of what it was, of course. And then later on in the session, we did the full length one, including my right leg is heavy, and it was his right leg that wasn't there. He'd had an above knee amputation, so in the thigh. So I was sort of observing closely, and nothing was occurring, and everything seemed to be quite comfortable. And when we got a course, I asked what his reaction was. And, oh, well, everybody, of course. I never start with the person first. If I know there's a particular issue with someone and I'm in a group, I will start the go round with somebody next to them. So I haven't gone immediately to them, just pinpointing, how did you get on with that? Because you've got the issue. No, I've started with, how did you get on, David? So get that report. Then I moved to him. And he said, it was extraordinary. I felt that my leg was there. And I said, so what's that like? What was it for you? And he said, it was lovely. So, you know, I was most surprised. I had no idea. It was lovely. And I have phantom pain. I haven't mentioned it while we've been here, but I do have phantom pain. It went away. And my thought, I don't know what your thoughts are. What are your thoughts hearing that story?
I'm very moved. I think it's wonderful that that happened for him.
Yep, yep. Any other thoughts?
It doesn't surprise me, actually.
No.
Because there's a lot of work with phantom pain. And the key to curing some of it or easing some of it is, because they use mirrors, don't they? If you've got, because of you've got a limb missing, so if you put a mirror, you look like you're symmetrical.
Oh, you've got the two, right?
Because you've still got the nerves that would feed it.
Yes.
That doesn't surprise me that he could almost feel his leg, and that it would bring him a lot of relief.
Yes.
Yeah.
Isn't that lovely? I didn't know that stuff and that research and the mirror and stuff, but for me, I was feeling, it is his whole body. And I think we said it there. I said, you know, you of course, once upon a time, you had a leg. That was your natural being. So how lovely. And yeah. So that was that story. So I think the message, the main message of it is actually, don't ever assume or second guess or I wonder what we do with this. We will always take them through the next exercise, whatever their circumstances, whatever their history, because doing one with you is never going to do any harm. And if it's difficult, then they are at least with you and you can discuss it and find a way around it or whatever. So, yeah. So there we are. That's my contribution on that one. And really, so the essence of an awful lot of this is actually we've got the circumstance, we're going to talk to the client, we're going to see what's possible or not possible and make our decisions from there. There isn't really a set answer to any of these. Okay. Motivating a client to practice autogenic exercises.
Anything to this one?
Yes.
Just because I had an aha moment with Anne earlier when we were talking about the 20-minute rest break, and it was Bev saying about the food. And I was thinking, how many of us actually try to override all those horrible feelings? You know, we were talking about the feelings we feel agitated and hungry and
yes.
everything when we need a rest. So we'll go and get a coffee or a sweets or, you know, yes. something to eat or something.
Yes.
So I think I might use that to say, well, if you haven't got any time to fit it in, if you're getting those feelings, what would you do? So instead of going and getting your coffee or a donut or a whatever, sit down for, it's not even 20 minutes, is it, as we were saying, but just sit down for 5 minutes and maybe do the autogenic exercises.
Good point.
So I just thought of that this morning.
Yes, I love that. And what it is also, sorry.
No, I was just saying it could reach people in a way that you're thinking, well, yeah, we all know about sort of going to the toilet and, you know, perhaps when you're waiting for the kettle, sit on the chair and all that. But this was something else. It's that you would have to do something because you know you need to do something. It. And what you're going to do is probably not beneficial for you, really. I know Patricia was saying she'd go for a walk and that's fine. But if you're going to go and get the coffee or the sugary sweets or the, you know, something else that isn't particularly good for you, this would be. So I wondered if it just would be another way in to somebody else.
Yes, it is another way in. It absolutely is. Because, of course, the trouble is we're a bit like school teachers at the beginning, aren't we? We're saying, well, this is what we're going to do and this is how you do it. And you do it this number of times a day and you do it with this and this and this and this. And sometimes that paralyzes people anyway. Mm. So you might be actually better off, actually, very nice awareness. How am I feeling at this moment? At the start, of course, sometimes people, they haven't got it. They haven't got in there. Mm. They're not really quite sure what they're supposed to be doing. They've got to go back on Friday and talk to that Jane Bird about their homework. It's all a bit like school. So there are things like that as well. But I love what you've just said, Donna, because it is about attending to oneself, isn't it? Mm. Yes. Yeah. And maybe there are phases of this. You know, week one is sometimes hard to get started, but once they're into week two and week three, then what you've just described is probably going to be very meaningful for them, whereas at week one, they're still sort of finding their way and haven't found their feet.
Yeah, absolutely. Mm. As they're becoming more aware of themselves.
Yeah.
Then yeah.
And yes. And of course, I'm never going to stop Sebastian getting his cup of coffee to keep himself going, because I do appreciate when you're working in a busy NHS environment, there isn't the opportunity. And that's one of the things we have to accept. But it doesn't mean that we can't ever do any. And you never know when that little moment will just arrive. But yes, I never do any when I'm at work. I mean, it's so silly. There I am teaching AT at the hospital. I never do any for myself on Fridays. Very rare.
Any time.
No. Exactly. So there we go. So a bit of motivation then is sometimes sort of round the back and talking things through with them. Well, what is your day like? And so on. So always talk.
May I ask a question, Jane? I use in my group when I start with my voice dialogue and they need to practice and whatever. And most of the people, they're not very kind to themselves. They put everyone forward before themselves. So I have found this helps so much. I set up a WhatsApp group, as I call it, you know, WhatsApp. And when they have done their voice dialogue, their exercise, they sent a thumbs up to the group.
Right.
That's and nice. The group loves it. It's not a big, I did this.
Yeah. Yeah, yeah.
It's just a thumbs up.
Yeah.
And then the other ones, they come up with their thumbs up. So they have their codes and just the emojis.
Yeah.
And that helps so much because they get positive feedback for the other and it just helps them.
Yeah.
Have you done anything like this with autogenic?
No. You have to realise that I started this with a manual typewriter and a pen and paper. I have no technology at all. I do use WhatsApp now, of course. Actually, certainly, the only time I do groups now is at the hospital, and we couldn't do that because that's GDPR and it's giving, you know, we would have to be with consent. If I were to run my own groups, I think that's a lovely idea. Is it a lovely idea? I don't know. I think it's one of those things where never quite sure. It might not suit one person in the group, and then they might become a bit sidelined. I don't know. So that's where I am. If it's already helpful for you, and the people that you work with, then I wouldn't quarrel with what you do in your own practice, Pia. But so there we are.
I'll give it a go.
Yeah.
Motivator. All my groups have set up WhatsApp groups.
Oh, they've done it for themselves.
They've done it themselves.
Yeah.
I don't know what they say, because obviously I'm not part of it.
No.
Because I can't be part of it. But I wonder if I just could say something like that, it might just be the motivation that they need. Get more thumbs up than each other. get a bit of a competition going or something. To get the
it could have a double-edged sword. We also have to be quite careful about the group dynamic, and if there is someone in the group, we get some weird wonderful people at the hospital who love to do this, and then they take charge. And then they are the ones who differ, and then they are doing this, but I do it like this, blah, blah, blah. And we don't know what's going on with that, so there is that element as well that we would have to be very careful with. But you know, in principle I think it's a nice idea, but I don't know, you know, it might be better for forgive me if I'm saying the wrong thing here, but better for a slimming club or something like that, or an exercise class or something. But then yours perhaps is more geared to that, but it's not for me to say, Pia. No.
Yeah, I'll give it a go. Okay. Try it out.
See what happens. Yes. See what happens. It could be quite a good topic for an essay.
Yeah.
And how autogenic is autogenic if people are doing their work according to the group? I think that's quite an interesting question to ask.
What was this, Jane? What did you say?
How autogenic is the client's autogenics? That's not a bad, that's a bad question. You know, we are doing self-help here. We are looking after ourselves. I know that all you're talking about is giving encouragement to everybody else. That's the motive. But it is quite an interesting question. Mm. It's also why, when people are saying, isn't there somewhere where we can have a collective where people can meet regularly, autogenics, we might put the forum on the website, there's things that da-da-da. Well, I started doing something like that in my own home because I used to do quite a lot of groups. And somebody suggested this. And so I thought, well, okay, I'll start. I'll start doing a monthly meeting, the first Wednesday of the month. And people can come along and have a refresher and talk about their AT. And I spread the news out to all my clients that, you know, for the previous 3 years or whatever it was. I mean, it wasn't that many, but it was a good enough number, probably about 20 people. And there we were already on that first Wednesday. Do you know who turned up?
No one.
Me. I did. Nobody else did.
That's amazing.
I was most intrigued. I tried again, and again nobody came. And I thought, it's really interesting what people think they need, and then in the moment they don't. And of course, there was no money involved, or there was no, I think I was going to charge a fiver or something, but I mean, you know, it wasn't any big deal. And it obviously wasn't a big enough deal to be attractive. And in the end, what we're doing is working on ourselves. It's autogenic. It's mine. If I don't need to go to that Wednesday evening, then I won't. I'll go and do something else instead. Fine. I didn't take it personally. I was a bit cross with the person who suggested it because I'd put quite a lot of work into it. And even that person didn't come, which was disappointing. I probably did an anger offloading on that one. But yes. Interesting. It is, isn't it? Because people think at the end of the course they're going to keep wanting support, and then they don't even realize that they don't.
Interesting.
Oh, where did that come from? Well, we've moved off somewhere.
We were motivating people.
Oh, motivating, we were, weren't we? Yes, yes, sorry, I have moved off. Right. Well, motivating offloading exercises. Any suggestions? What about a role play? Okay, I'll make something up. I'm reporting on my week of warmth exercises. So I've had a really funny week. The exercises were so long, I kept losing my place. I couldn't get what I was doing. People kept interrupting. I was just getting more and more aggravated with this flipping warmth exercise. And then thinking, oh, I'm not doing it properly. I can't get on. I don't know. And actually, I have felt really angry this week. And no, I must be a bit further on, mustn't I? Because Donna hasn't introduced the anger exercise. I felt really cross. Okay. But I have learned the anger exercise. So what are you going to say to me?
Well, I will say that if you have forgotten about the sheet that was given out to you, in the way of how are you feeling in being so aggravated? Is it feeling good? And what would you say? So Jane, is it feeling good for you?
No, it's horrible. I'm just feeling, I thought this course was going to actually make me sort of generally calm down and just sort of feel more, but it's not, it's the opposite. And I really didn't like that long exercise. But
do you know why? One of the reasons why we have the offloading exercises to help you in a situation like that. So what I would suggest you could do is to do the exercise and sit.
Which exercise? Which exercise?
One.
We talked about that last week.
Remember? So it is to verbalize it, to get it out of your body so it's not held in your body, so you release it. That is why we got the exercise. So that might be an idea. Do you want to do it now? We can do it together. Would that be an idea? So you can get into it. Would that be anything to do that now?
I don't know.
Would you do it later?
In fact, stepping out of role, Luther would say absolutely no, never. Never. Never encourage somebody to do an anger exercise with you, with anybody else.
Oh, this is good to know.
That's important to know. So I'm very glad we're saying that. No. So my immediate instinct when you suggested that with me in role was, no, I don't want to do that. And so I don't know whether that was me in role or because of this. No, he said, the thing with emotions is that they are ours and we have internalized them. Then that's not a useful thing to do. If we're moving them out and externalizing them, then they are out there. But if somebody else is in the room, what am I doing with my anger? I'm throwing it at that person. And then,
that makes sense. Yeah.
Then we get, okay, you're a sympathetic person and you could take it, I'm quite sure. But the idea is actually not to involve anyone else. And
so really it's just to remind them that they have that and to go home and do that
and
on
do it
their own.
Yes, yes. And so how my role might have gone on to isn't that silly on me? I mean, I've been feeling so sort of, I won't say it's angry actually, I think I've been feeling agitated and edgy, but I'd completely forgotten that there was something else to do, so I'm thanking you for reminding me. Okay, so I've just got to speak out loud, have I? And I know what I've been angry with. Yes, right. Okay, I'll do that. Thank you. And I know exactly when I'm going to do it and who it's going to be about. Thank you. Okay. That's my role finished for today.
Right.
Can I say something?
Yes, Sebastian, of
I
course.
remember, I would say it's quite funny but sad experience. A couple of about 7 years ago, I was chatting with a patient with paranoid schizophrenia, and he told me how he got sucked. And he was having hearing hallucinations, and he used to work in the office, and all of a sudden he was hearing voices, and he started shouting, "Get out of my head, leave me alone." And everyone in the room, you know, got like scared. What is this guy? They didn't know he's got, you know, schizophrenia. He had perhaps a crisis, and because of that, he got sucked. That's it. So I think, yeah, as you're saying, yeah, it's not appropriate, you know, to practice, you know, whether there are other people, you know, present, and they don't know what are they doing, what are you doing, you know, they might take it personally. They might think you might have a problem with them.
Yes. And well, I mean, absolutely right. It is. It'd be terrifying, especially when it came out of the blue. What different contexts they are, though, aren't they? There he was at a day at work, sitting at his desk, and then the problem came up for him, and that was his spontaneous reaction.
Yes,
That's
yes.
very, very different to me being a
I know.
pretend client with peer who
Yeah,
is offering.
yeah,
So,
yeah,
you
yeah.
know, it's very useful for us to get both those contexts in place, and actually, neither of them are appropriate, really. And then quite often, people will say when they are doing an anger exercise, or they're not doing it, rather. That's an interesting one. Yes, my role play here would be being asked by peer, maybe, have I done any anger offloading? Did I have a go at that new exercise? Oh, no, I have. I got a wonderful husband. He's absolutely brilliant. And anything that's bothering me, I talk to him about, and he's brilliant. How would you reply to that?
Oh, it's still that you're offloading to somebody else, then, isn't
Absolutely.
it?
And I think I've said this word to you in our previous sessions, is dumping. So I've come home from a bad day at work, and my poor husband is there. He's cooked dinner. He's absolutely lovely. And all I can do is talk and talk and talk about that horrible day at work. Poor chap. And in fact, I did that once. I'm telling this honestly. And I got home, and he was just brilliant. Martin was standing in the kitchen and leaning against the counter, and he and I was saying, "Oh, there was this," and then, "Oh, you won't forget it." And it was this, and it was it. Might have been trains and something. It didn't matter. Just silly. But that was what I was doing. And he said, "I can't do this now." And that pulled me up and pulled me to my senses. And I said, "Thank you so much. I'm so sorry. That was a dreadful thing to do." And it was great. So I think I probably went and stomped around upstairs or something like that and came down, and we had dinner or whatever it was, and all was well. But I thanked him for stopping me doing that dumping. It was out of order. So there we go. And that was out of his awareness and so on. He probably had his own troubles in his own day. I wasn't giving him a chance. There is another thing about talking about anger out loud to somebody else, and we think we're doing an offloading exercise. We're not. We're just talking to somebody else. They are listening. They are going to answer you back with a new idea, or have you thought about this, or what about that? Oh, I'm sure it isn't as bad as you say, or shall we try some forgiveness, or something like this. And actually, that isn't helpful. That is not allowing you to offload, because you're doing it in the wrong context. Our offloading now needs to be on our own. The freedom, you've discovered it, Sebastian, the freedom to say exactly what we want to say in exactly how we want to say it. And it gives also your own brain freedom to move from one person or a topic to another. And the work we do on our own actually leads us in the right directions. But as soon as you've got somebody else putting a pennyworth in, it's not always helpful. Even a nice therapist, even somebody who is. But you could always say, what do you want to do to that person? Or, you know, is it that sort of anger? Or is it about the universe? Or is it about a person? What would you really like to do? And when the answer comes back, oh, I could kill them. You could say, well, we all know that you won't, but Can you find a private space at home, the garden shed, or on a walk on the beach, or something or other, and you are perfectly at liberty to say, I could kill you, Simon, I could kill you, Simon, I could kill you, Simon, you're a bastard, you're a bastard. And you can demonstrate for them what they can do, giving them permission.
Good.
Okay. These are revision, aren't they? These are good for revision.
Jane, could I ask something? I know there are some clients who are absolutely terrified of the anger exercise.
Good point.
And I know that, you know, I've given, you know, the information that, you know, it's not about shouting and screaming and throwing things unless you want to, but you can talk very quietly. You can even whisper, or you can write. Yes. And I've never had anybody who's admitted that they've written it down. They don't seem to like to do that. But do you get many people who do take that course of writing?
Patricia, thank you so much. You're absolutely right. Donna, you want to say something. You are absolutely right.
Yeah, I had somebody who wasn't comfortable with the anger, but also she lived during COVID with her husband, who is vulnerable. So there was no escape, apart another room, but thin walls. So. Mm. And it was him that she wanted to scream at.
Yeah.
So she was very, she couldn't do anything with it. So she wrote and it did help her. But most people, I think, do prefer sort of saying it, even if it's whispering it. But yeah, I have had good results with writing as well for her.
And thank you so much for that, because actually this is really important, because everybody has heard about the letter you never send. Which, you know, is quite common practice, isn't it? Mm. And then what I often say is that if it is difficult at first, because it is good to speak it and have your mouth saying the words, it is in the hot air, it converts itself into just hot air in the end. It loses its energy by speaking it out. However, if it's difficult to start or you're not sure, then yes, write the letter. But please don't start it with Dear Bob, you know, just write angrily on a piece of old newspaper and do it angrily. Or if you have written something that's a bit coherent, why not use that as a script for doing your anger exercise? So that you've actually done both. You've done some writing and then you're going to say, actually, you're an effing B, or whatever you need to say in quite succinct language. And that is doing it too. And you might surprise yourself how quickly you'd start laughing.
Oh, yes.
That's the other end of what you were talking, isn't it? Yeah.
I really laughed the first time I did it. It was great. I was in a fantastic mood.
Yes.
Yeah. So
I often say it sort of changes the energy of the feeling as soon as it's outside and we are expressing ourselves. There's an awful lot on anger, actually, because I'm reminded, you know, by that really good question, all the sort of nuances of why people don't do them. And really, the nub of it all, of course, is to ask the client, what's happening? And I played the role of somebody who'd forgotten all about it, which is very common. And yet, at the same time, not being aware of myself, even to jog the memory that we had done this last week. So there was that. And then there are some people, of course, who actually will never do the anger exercise. They are actually afraid of their anger. And that might be why they are suffering from anxiety, non-specific anxiety. However, when we get to the crying exercise, that might be the one for them.
Yeah.
So Joe will practice the anger exercise because they love it. As I was saying, was it? Only yesterday, talking about the chap at British Airways in the engineering lot. Was I saying that? Or was it? No. It was another time. Anyway, this guy was just got the main thing he got out of autogenics was the anger exercise. And all his mates used to tease him for muttering in the corner. But they understood what he was doing. And that was a good thing. Sorry, I've muddled that up with you lot. That's not the right way. But if anger really isn't suiting someone, actually they can do the crying exercise. It might well do the same job, but that's not this question. Are you surviving all right there, Pia? Are you all right? Yeah, Shall we whiz through to the end? The diary. I think the main thing about the diary is that if they're going to write something down after their exercise session, they are really paying attention during the exercise to what is going on. Notice what you notice. And then that helps the feedback each week when you bring the diary to each session. Helps the memory.
Jane, do you get a lot of clients that don't do it, that don't actually write?
Yeah.
Really?
Luther used to refuse to work with people who didn't keep a diary. If we did that at the hospital, we wouldn't have any patients at all. I don't know about you, Donna, but hardly anybody keeps a diary at the hospital. I always talk about the diary.
And why is it that they don't do it?
What do they say?
Is it too busy or...?
I think too busy, and some people don't like writing. It reminds them of school. I do say, please use your phones now if you don't want to do writing in a book. You know, jot things down in your phone. And some people do really diligently. They bring pages and pages each week. And that can be sometimes quite tedious because they say, well, on Monday at 10 o'clock, I sat down and I didn't. That can take a long time. So you've got to be slightly careful. But then you get the others who really, really don't. And I'm used to working that way, to be perfectly honest with you. But an ideal is a good diary. It really is.
Patricia? I can tell you about something I do to try and get around that. I buy these selections of nice little notebooks when there's a sale on or something in a stationery shop, just small ones. And after I've discussed the diary and told about how important the diary is, etc., I sort of produce a few of those and say, would you like to choose one for your diary? And they take it. And I think they start then filling the diary out, you know, out of guilt, because I've given them this to, and I say, look, it's very small because you don't have to sort of write pages, you know, just
bullet
points are perfectly fine. So it's just the right size. it works, not perfectly for all of them. They'll say they forgot it and things like that. But at least it's better getting some of them doing it every week rather than, you know, the number that could possibly be. So, and I quite enjoy that. Part of it, you know.
That's fun. That is fun. And I've in my private practice, I get, and if I'm meeting them in person, of course, it doesn't happen all that often now. But I always gave them a little pocket notebook just this size. And you're quite right; it is the size that stops them writing too much. And I'm always very careful to say it is not journaling. It is not journaling. We're not going round into he said, she said, what I might do, and all of this. We're just writing one word things that we've noticed during our practice. Yeah. And if any other thoughts are attached to that, jot those down too. But that's all. It must be brief. I call it a logbook, actually. And in week one, after their very first practice of short stitch, and they've done a whole series of ins and outs, and we get to the end of that, I say, right now, what are your comments? And let's write them down now. Let's get your diary started now while we're together. And that's sometimes a useful thing to do as well. Yeah.
Do you find that the people that don't write their diaries, that they quit, or is there a difference?
Is interesting. No, they don't. And I think, I was going to say, times have moved on since Luther's day and, you know, his strictness. And we couldn't. I really couldn't. I think for some people it would almost be torture to write a diary just because of the mindset, and they can't be bothered. But then you get the person who is keeping a diary, and I've got somebody I'm working with at the moment who on the first sort of two or three sessions anyway, she was saying, I said, how are you getting on? Oh, I really don't know. I am doing the exercises. And I'm saying, so what's going on in the exercise? Well, I haven't got anything to say. I really haven't. And so then I see a diary popping out of her bag and said, well, have you got anything in your notebook there? And then she picks up her notebook and she tells me all sorts of things, that she had a tingly elbow and she had a something else and a bit of a headache and a this and a that and a tummy rumble and stuff. See, I don't know why you're saying there's nothing to tell me. And she said, well, nothing's changing. You're looking for changes. We're not doing that. We're just noticing what is there. And so, and she's been extraordinary, actually. She was the one who had the bereavement in the middle, and she's coming back, and now she is actually sleeping. But she, that was what she was wanting. She was wanting to tell me good news. And I said, there's no such thing as good news. It's just what you noticed. So, and that's the good news. So, So I, in all honest truth, some people have got amazing things out of it. And I think I will say that the most amazing ones probably did keep a diary because they have engaged with the whole caboodle. And very often it's those people who are saying, I look back in my diary. That's always the key. I look back in my diary and I see what I was writing before. And I gosh, you know, I'm just completely different now. So it still is very meaningful when people do it.
Yeah.
But it doesn't mean that people who don't never get anything out of it. I don't know about you, Donna.
I think you've covered most of the things. I find most people don't do it. But in the group, as you go around, that might trigger, oh, God, yes. No, I did have some tingling.
Yes,
or
yes, yes.
But, yeah, they, on the whole, they don't keep a diary.
Yeah. And let's face it, people's lives are so busy. Everybody's working. It's hard enough to get their practice in, you know. So yeah. we've got to be reasonable. I mean, sometimes I say, well, look, why not do a summary at the end of the day? How was your autogenics and what did you notice and how have you been feeling and how did you deal with what situation? I sometimes say that. And it sometimes gets them going a bit. Yeah. We must move on. What do we do when we're teaching AT, which keeps the client process comfortable and safe? There aren't many. I'll start you off for the sake of time, and I can see we've had a long day. Okay. What do we do right at the very, very start of an autogenic process?
The assessment. The assessment.
Thank you. We have had enough, haven't we? The assessment. Stage one. Okay.
The environment is very important, you know. Not
particularly. I've taught autogenics in all sorts of funny places.
No, I mean, at the beginning.
I don't think about safety. I don't think that's about safety, actually. Not necessarily.
I mean, but it has to be comfortable, for example.
Well, it does have to be comfortable. You are right there. You are right there. But the process, what is the process doing? What is it doing? What do we listen out for? How do we do the exercises so they practice properly? Okay.
Check their posture.
Yes, but that's not so much about safety. That's more about actually getting into the autogenic state because they might not be relaxed. So you are right, Rosin. Okay, it's the close. The close, actually, is the biggest safeguard we've got.
Oh, yeah, of course.
Yes. And that we're tired now. This is the wrong moment to be doing this, I think. Because I know that you know the answers. It's just that we've asked the question in a new way to think about it.
Mm.
Do you agree with that, Donna?
Yes, I was just looking at the question thinking, I know we tried to rewrite
it. We did.
We need to rewrite it again somehow.
I think the previous way was worse than this one, but anyway.
Yes, but I still don't think we've quite got it, actually. So
no.
That's our fault.
Yes, that is our fault. I think we finish here because you know the answer to question number 7. We've talked about it before. I think we've done quite enough. It is, we want to make sure that 11-year-olds do not go out teaching autogenic training. And they wouldn't.
Well, it's really anyone, isn't it? They should be trained.
Exactly. It's an obvious answer. They should be trained. Yes.
Yeah.
And you know why. I know you do. So I don't think we need to worry about any more. You look as though you're about to say something, Sebastian, but perhaps...
Sometimes you may see, I mean, you might come across some sort of, let's say, pseudo therapist. They teach, you know, they do like 100, you know, teaching methods. So normally you should stick to one and two, keep that. But I mean, you cannot do hypnosis, coaching, I don't know, AT, counseling, you know, I mean, maybe some people are qualified, but when you see that someone is providing like, you know, 200 methods, I would question.
Yes. Yes. And of course, what we don't know is that anybody we teach could go out there and decide to teach their best friends and their grandmothers and all sorts of other things, which is a big mistake. So, but we can't monitor, we can't be responsible for that.
Well, on the other hand, I believe, I mean, in UK, perhaps they need to be, you know, like at least registered, you know, a member of the, you know, Autogenic Society, you know, yes. Just to, you know, just to be genuine, I would say.
Absolutely, of course. And then, of course, you can get practitioner insurance and all the rest of it. Hmm. But autogenics is a very safe method as long as it's managed properly.
Yeah, well, I was practicing autogenic and it was like 180 degrees different than, you know, what you're teaching me. What so it doing? Was actually the proper AT autogenic training, you know.
And there more are than that,
variants, you know.
More than that, what you were doing could have provoked a process that neither you nor the trainer understood and wouldn't have known how to manage. So sure. that's really the key thing.
Mm.
And hundreds of people might learn it perfectly safely from their school teacher or somebody who hasn't got the proper qualification, but there will be one or two who are in real, real trouble, and that should never happen. Yeah.
One thing I'd say to just watch out for is that you do get clients that come in and that you're teaching them autogenics and they've got in mind, oh, I'm going to take this home. My husband could do with a bit of that. And, oh, my best friend or my mum, my daughter. So I'll learn from you. Then I'm going to go home and tell them to do what you've just told me to do. And because I've had a couple of people that I've thought, you're doing something with this. And I've had to stop them, or they've said, "Oh yeah, we do it together. I've got my sister involved, and we do it together now." What do you mean you do it together now? So that can be just something to. They're trying to share it and do a good thing, but obviously they don't know what we're looking out for. So just to be aware that could be a possibility that people will do that.
You're absolutely right.
How do you deal with that, Donna?
Sorry, Pia.
How do you deal with that?
Oh, I just tell them again. Well, I don't think. Do I tell them in the start? I don't know. But I would just remind them that it is their process.
Mm.
So we don't want to involve anybody else. We want to concentrate solely on them. But also I do flag up that I'm trained in this to be looking out for the process and managing it that they're not. Mm. So I come at it both ways and I try and take the pressure off them because it's their process. They don't want to be teaching anybody else. They want to be learning and doing it for themselves. That's what they're there for. Mm. But I do mention obviously the safety aspect that they're not trained and they don't comes next. So
that's extremely important. I'm so glad you brought that up. And the other thing that has happened for me on occasion has been they say, my husband, well, I think you've said it already, haven't you, actually? Yes, I've given it to my husband. We're doing it at night for sleep. And so I've said for the same reason. But another thing I add is this is actually a serious psychotherapeutic technique. We must regard it in that light. Otherwise, we're not going to be properly respectful for it or attentive to it. So there's that. And you all know, don't you, going around the group, what you've done to get here. We had quite an assessment. We've talked about the history. We've talked about your situation. We've talked about quite a number of things pertinent before starting your course of autogenics. Teaching, I would never, ever teach anybody that I hadn't done that with. And so I say that very firmly. That's my own thing, yeah. But I forgot to say it here. Thank you so much, Donna. You're quite right. Right.
Have we all run out of steam?
I think we have, and somebody needs to go to bed. I don't know what time it is, Pia, where you are.
It's 9 minutes past one in the morning.
Oh, you need to go to bed.
And I arrived too late to ask you how you are, Pia, after yesterday.